This is Michael Cowan, and welcome to Trial Lawyer Nation.
You are the leader in the courtroom, and you want the jury to be looking to you for the answers.
When you figure out your theory, never deviate.
You want the facts to be consistent, complete, and credible.
The defense has no problem running out the clock. Delay is the friend of the defense.
It's tough to grow a firm by trying to hold on and micromanage.
You've got to front load a simple structure for jurors to be able to hold on to.
What types of creative things can we do as lawyers, even though we don't have a trial setting?
Whatever you've got to do to make it real, you've got to do to make it real. But the person who needs convincing is you.
Welcome to the award-winning podcast, Trial Lawyer Nation. Your source to win bigger verdicts, get more cases, and manage your law firm. And now, here's your host, noteworthy author, sought-after speaker, and renowned trial lawyer, Michael Cowan.
We're going to start a new feature on this podcast. It's Ask Michael and Mallory Anything. If you have anything you'd like to ask either Mallory or me, we're going to start doing an episode every couple months where we're going to answer your questions. So just send them in to me at michael@cowanlaw.com, and Mallory and I will answer them. Anything from, you know, legal strategy, marketing management, anything else in life you want to talk about, we'll be glad to talk about it with you. Again, ask Michael and Mallory anything. Just send us an email. We'll be glad to answer your questions. Welcome to today's Trial Lawyer Nation. Joining us today is a great friend to both me and to the podcast, Michael Leeserman. Michael, how are you doing today?
Oh, I'm doing great. Thank you for having me back, Michael.
Well, thanks. You know, I try not to just have the same guests over and over, but you got an $82.1 million verdict on what was supposed to have been a pretty tough case, and I thought it would be useful to learn how you did it.
Oh, yeah. Happy to talk about it. I'm so thrilled for my clients. You know, part of the reason for that verdict is just worthy clients. I think that's always important. So Michael Schenck was badly injured when he was hit by a truck on his motorcycle. It traumatically amputated his left leg and so badly injured his left arm that it ultimately had to be amputated after a little more than a year. So you have these horrible injuries. Amazing person. We'll talk more about that, but just one of the most likable clients I've ever had, and his wife the same. So we're in a very conservative, what's considered a conservative venue. I don't even know what that means anymore, other than kind of votes red. In Steubenville, Ohio, we were in state court.
Yeah, I don't think there's any correlation between how people vote and how they roll in jurors as jurors anymore.
I agree 100%.
I think unless you go in there with the attitude that you can't trust them, and you create like negative energy when you start because of your own. But I think if you trust the jurors, they're good people.
Absolutely.
So how did the crash happen?
Yeah. So this is the tough part of the case. When I got the case, how did it happen? There's lots of ways to look at it. The way I like to look at it, and of course we get to frame it because we go first, is that a commercial truck driver was speeding through an intersection with his cruise control on, not looking to see what was there to be seen, essentially driving through the intersection blind, so much so that he didn't know what he hit. He claimed something hit him.
Oh, wow.
And we say that he hit the motorcycle, and there were other lawyers on this for a long time. This happened 8 years ago, and they took his deposition, and it just wasn't adequate. And I don't know how else to say it. There's not a nicer way. When I take a deposition, I want the details. I want to know exactly where the truck driver was looking, what they're doing with their hands and feet, and just all the details possible, so that they can't create a different story when they're in trial. And because I want to understand exactly what happened. So when I asked him, when we, you know, this other side fought, the case had been dismissed, and then We refiled it after I was brought in. And we'll get to it, but it's important to know that a whole team was brought in. So there was a law firm that had it. There was a lawyer who was helping work it and then left the firm and then decided to bring in, and that was George Sideropoulos, who's a great lawyer. He asked Aaron DeShaw and myself to enter the case. Aaron, of course, a wonderful trial lawyer, owner of Trial Guides, and he's also a chiropractor. I mean, his medical knowledge much better than mine will ever be. So he came in to deal with a lot of the medicine around amputation and those type of things. And then George also asked me to come in on the trucking part. So we fought to get to redepose the truck driver. Defense counsel objected and said, no, it's already been taken in the first case. Just because you're refiled, you don't get to retake it. Bloods goes back and forth on that. And I convinced the judge, just give us 2 hours. I'll limit it to 2 hours. And defense lawyer cut it off right at 2 hours. I think I wound it down. And I was able to just really get in and spend that 2 hours getting the details of what the truck driver was looking at, what he wasn't looking at. Like I said, never saw the motorcycle. And I said, so when you ended up with your truck, going over the median and, you know, there was some impact that you heard and felt when you got out of your truck, for all you knew, a deer had hit the truck. He said, yeah, could have been a deer. I had no idea what I hit. So that was really what we went with, what I would call the logical court truth, that you don't drive through intersection blindly. And the physical core truth, I think of things this way, was that the truck driver didn't know what he hit or what hit him. So that became very important. Now, from the other side, and why a lot of other lawyers had turned down this case, and some crash reconstructionists who I've worked with on many cases refused to support the case, was from the other side, they would say the case sounded something like this. There's a motorcyclist who pulls out in front of or hits the side of, just runs into the side of a truck. When the police come, there's the odor of alcohol on him. He had come from a bar, so he's an intoxicated motorcyclist who just runs into the side of a truck. And there was a lot of discussion in the trial about where the impact was. The crash reconstruction put the impact so that our motorcycle was in the truck driver's lane. So that's how defense, I think, would have described the case.
But I guess if the truck driver either A, was not speeding, or B, was paying attention, he would have been able to avoid the crash.
Yeah, and so that's what we come back to over and over again, and what the defense comes back to over and over again is we were in the truck driver's lane. So right from the beginning, we framed it as if we hit the truck, we lose. If the truck hit us, we win. And then we said, and ultimately what the jury ended up, what one of the jurors, for the last decade or so, I haven't talked to the jury afterwards. It's just, I don't know why. I just don't. I don't know that it helps any. But
I agree.
Local counsel who I brought in saw one of the jurors the day after the verdict, small town, and she had said, we thought the motorcycle was probably in the path of the truck, but we didn't care. The truck driver should have been looking. So we built this two-part trial, which the first part that was most important is you don't drive through an intersection blind. And then we said, for those of you who care, it doesn't really matter exactly where the point of impact is, because if he'd been looking, if the truck driver had been looking, this would have never happened. But for those of you who might care, let's take a look at that. And one of the things we said is there is no lane through the intersection. We're talking about an imaginary line that would divide the two sides. And this is a curved intersection. So the police are drawing a straight line, a straight imaginary line, not a curved imaginary line. And So there was this balance of wanting to answer that question for jurors who cared and saying it doesn't really matter. I think the jurors didn't care and just said you don't drive through blindly.
Now, I've heard people say at seminars that you always have to make the case about the company and not the driver. Did you have any corporate bad acts, or was it purely a driver?
Yeah, I guess I'm a contrarian because I would disagree with that, but you know that about me.
Yeah.
When there's a bad company, then point it out. Absolutely. Not only because that's going to drive damages many times, but because it helps us make the world a safer place. There are times when the company is not bad. And the last trial I had, we talked about this on one of your podcasts. I went out of my way to actually put on, just to kind of disprove that theory because it bothers me, to put on like 5 to 10 minutes of video deposition where I was praising the company for their safety policies. Here it was somewhere in between. And that was a big verdict. So you don't have to have that. That's for sure. When it's there, great, grab on it. This case, it was there were two companies that employed this driver, and there was a big dispute about that. One was an energy company that does like fracking, like dynamites and explosives for fracking. This is the easternmost part of Ohio on the West Virginia border. And the other company was a cement truck company. So we have these companies, and we had this driver was in a commercial motor vehicle, a large truck, that he did maintenance like on the cement trucks and things like that. And he was on his way from one location to another. So I did allege that there should have been better safety culture, that their safety, there should have been training because they didn't train this guy. He was grandfathered into the his CDL way back when. We made that argument. We put Adam Grill on the stand to talk about that, who's a truck driving expert. And I realized as we went through the case, and Adam did a great job. I just realized as we went through the case, that was not the sexy part. That was, I wish they had done more, but I de-emphasized it so much that in closing, I felt like I really had a great connection with the jurors. And I went through and told them what I wanted line by line on the jury questions. And when I got to negligence of the one company and negligence of the other company, I said, you might want to answer yes here. I think that it was inadequate, the training they did. I'm not, is that a cause? Maybe. I'm not as concerned about that as some of these other things that we've heard. And I really gave them permission to answer no to those two questions, and they did. I think I could have pushed it and gotten yes on those. I just didn't think I needed it, and it wasn't the most egregious company ever.
Yeah, I think that's so important. And I think it's essential that we always look for corporate bad conduct and look for, big grand root causes. When it's not there, we lose credibility by trying to push something that's not true, because we win with the truth and we win with our credibility. And I think you are very wise not to lose your credibility over some dogmatic statement you heard at a seminar somewhere. And I have these discussions with my lawyers all the time. They're like, well, I don't think it's a very good case because I can't find any company bad conduct. And I'm like, well, do you need it? I mean, it's nice when you have it. It's icing on the cake, but do you need it? On the other hand, in focus groups, we have found that jurors would prefer to blame a company than an individual if they can, for whatever that's worth. But there still has to be some meat to it.
Yeah. I agree with all that. And, you mentioned credibility. I would love to have this discussion with you because I do these trial guides tip of the day. It's free. If anyone, I can give a little plug, can I? You can go to Substack, Zen Lawyer, and it's just a tip of the day that I do. And so the reason I mention it is part of that. I have the privilege and honor, just like you do, of talking to great trial lawyers. And so over and over in those tips of the day and then talking to just amazing, Randy McGinn and Rick Friedman and Bill Barton and on, Lisa Blue. What I hear over and over is credibility. When we look at Mo Levine's books, just over and over, credibility is the most important thing. And you just said it. And so lately, something that's just been really fascinating to me, and I love asking other trial lawyers, is what does it mean to be credible? I can give you some examples from this trial of where I thought it was very important. And I think everyone will agree, or most everyone, that credibility is the most important virtue or attribute that we have at trial. What does that mean? Is it honesty? Is it vulnerability, believability? And what gives you those things? I'm curious your thoughts on that before I give you maybe some examples of how I thought credibility worked in this trial for me.
Yeah, to me, credibility starts with trusting the jury, I've learned. And so it means I trust the jury enough that I can tell the whole truth and believe that they're smart and good enough to get the truth without me having to twist anything around, so that I can tell the truth of my story, good, bad, and ugly. That I can embrace the parts of my case that aren't perfect, that I'm not trying to answer a law school exam and, you know, check every possible cause of action and make every possible argument, but that I can trust the jury and trust the case enough to distill it down to the actual core truths that we win with and tell those truths and accept life for what it is.
I love that. What I love about that is that you're saying credibility is not just something that I say or an action I take, but it's actually a mental state. I would almost say like an energetic state, but certainly a mind state of trust, that you're trusting the jury. And I think that is super important. And it really comes across in your body and your presentation. If you're there to strike jurors, if you're there to embrace jurors, and I would say we can do both of those, but we certainly want to embrace those that end up on the panel.
Absolutely. And it's taken a lot of work. I used to think credibility was about the story and about the facts. And as I've matured in my trial presentations or my trial work, I've learned it's a lot more about my attitude, my energy flow, my thought work, I guess mindfulness work. And I think the biggest things is my self-talk and my meditation before trial, as opposed to, you know, that leads to the credibility in the courtroom. And because a lot of times things just come up you aren't prepared for. How do you handle them? And when you can be honest and truthful about it, it really helps.
Yeah, I had some of those experiences here. And I think a couple ways that I believe credibility ended up entering the trial. And some of these I look for, you know, one was in jury selection. There was a woman who said, I know the Shanks. I provided daycare after this happened. I provided daycare for their child for a few months. And, the judge said, did you like him? Yeah. And how well do you know? I knew him pretty well. And, you know, do you think they would have any advantage? Well, you know, I would still be fair. I know them and they're good people. So that's nice. That's nice for the jury to hear. And then I start talking with her and say, you know, you really like them. They're nice people. I get that. And I would love to have you on this jury. I think you'd be a great juror. And I think part of the reason I think that is like you're inclined toward them a little bit from the start. And what I'm wondering is like, if you were the other side, though, would you want you to be on this jury, or might you be a little nervous about that? And I phrase it in a way where it kind of lowers the bar and like, well, no, yeah. I might be a little nervous about that, or however I asked it. And I said something like, as much as I would love to have you on this jury, as much as winning for the Shanks is very important for me, I want to do everything I can for them, there's something more important, and that's this process, and that it must be objective and fair. And Judge, we would move to strike this juror. I hope you can understand why. I just think the fairness of the process requires it. So that was something that I look for, and that's right away. And I meant everything I said. It's not performative. And I'm well aware that this was a chance to show we actually do care about the truth in the courtroom.
And on the converse, it had you gone and asked the questions, you know, basically led them to avoid a cause challenge. Well, you could be fair. You could set aside that aside. You would follow the law. You're telling those jurors you don't care about the truth. You care about winning, whether winning with the truth or not.
You're right. I could have forced the other side to use a peremptory on her. And that's something that, you know, right away I need to show I'm credible.
So I think that's one of the difference between, I guess, law school trial advocacy programs and actual winning trial advocacy when you get experienced, is the credibility being more important than winning that one little battle of, well, I'm going to make them use one of their strikes on this friendly juror.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Wow, there's a lot of other examples, but I know there's maybe other things we want to talk about.
Well, I think if you have another example, I think nothing's more important than credibility in the courtroom. So,
yeah. So this was something very interesting that happened throughout, and that's that in the opening statement, and I'll talk about this in a minute because it was one of my big fears that I faced, and that was having a big team. But in the opening statement, there's a visual. So I've got the truck driver with statements that he's made from his deposition, and then take his image of his torso and face and put over his face a blindfold I'd just gotten from like iStock Photo. So then the opening statement, which John Bond and the lawyer in my office gave, said, and it's as if he were driving blind through this intersection. And there's an objection that's improper in opening. And we dealt with it and moved on. And then the defense closing starts with, how dare they belittle a veteran by putting a mask over his face? How dare they belittle this veteran? He said he's very upset about this. And how dare they? And kind of went on and on. And I think that, like so many cases, that probably our team won the case as much as maybe defense lost the case. and so then I've got a dilemma of what to do with this. And what I end up doing, which is very much a decision in the moment, is I stand up for second close for the rebuttal, and I pause. It's pretty long pause because I actually don't know what I'm going to say at this moment. And I let the jury see that process, right? The process of getting to the truth is more interesting than just what the truth is. So I am a little torn because on one hand, I think this whole thing about a veteran is the lawyer just making something out of nothing. And on the other hand, though, he said that the truck driver was very bothered by this. And so I'm going to take him at his word on that. And I turned to the truck driver and had to find a way for this to come from an honest place. Again, it can't be performative. I didn't defend it. I didn't say, I never said anything about you being a veteran. I said, I looked him in the eyes and, Mr. Gerner, I apologize to you. I'm sorry. I regret that was in there. You know, the opening while John Bond gave it, I'm the one that created the visuals and I'm the one that put that visual in there. I take 100% responsibility. You know, if I were doing it as part of an opening statement, I would have probably just put my hands over my eyes and said, it's as if he were driving blindly through. That's what I was trying to do. And it was improper. It was wrong. Please know it has nothing to do with you being a veteran. Thank you from the bottom of my heart for your service to our country. And that's the one thing that I regret in this trial. It's the only thing I do, but please accept my apologies. And said it very sincerely. And then turned back to the jury and said, and I will accept, I hadn't planned this, it just came to me. Like, I will accept when I do something wrong. Take personal responsibility for it. And that's really what this case is about, is personal responsibility. So let's talk about that. So it's those opportunities in the courtroom to act in a way that, I guess in NLP, they'd say it's a pattern interrupt, but it's really just credibility. It's not acting the way they might think that a jury might think you would as an advocate, but actually acting as a human being. And that really resonates with jurors.
Now, every case, there's things, every case that makes it to trial, at least there's, you know, at least someone thinks they have some kind of defense. I'm always have something at some point in trial where I'm like, crap, what, how am I going to get past this? Why am I doing this? And you usually overcome it, but did you have any fears that you had to deal with in this trial?
Well, I didn't have fears about how the crash happened. You know, we dealt with those. We did deal with alcohol and emotion and limine. It's very important for me to say that Michael Schenck was not intoxicated that day. I'm 100% positive about that. We interviewed bartenders. He had one beer a long time before. He navigated the roads fine with his motorcycle. There were no blood alcohol levels run. He was not intoxicated. This truck driver hit him because he wasn't looking where he was going. And it's important for me to put that out there in the world. I love my client. He's a great guy. Of course, in the case, we preferred not to have that in and filed a motion in limine and won that. There were other fears, though, that weren't about the truth of the case. Because like you said, I'll put on the whole truth. I'll put on the truth. And it's funny to say that because there's some things we file motions in limine on. But okay, aside from that, I want to present the whole truth, the good, the bad, the ugly, right? But what actually I was afraid of in this case were two things. The first was, this was the first trial that I had a full team trying the case. So most of my trials have been myself just and my paralegal. Kim and I sit in that trial table. You know, if I have a referring lawyer, they might be sitting there writing notes, but they're not active in the past. And here, so we had Aaron Deshaw doing the economist and a prosthetic expert, John Bond, who's a great lawyer in my office. This was his first opening. How's that for his first real trial? He's got a great record. We try to keep it going. But he did opening and our liability experts. I did jury selection and the family, a husband and wife, and then closing. And that's the first time I did that. And so there was certainly a part of me that was afraid of giving up that control because it's always worked well for me doing it all. And I realized that wasn't really a rational fear. These are great lawyers that I'm teamed up with. And I let myself recognize that fear and just lean into it and enjoy having other people prepping for a direct and not trying to do it all myself, being up till 3 a.m. Doesn't mean there weren't still some late nights, but we also had a lot of fun. We rented an Airbnb in right across the river in West Virginia. And you know, we'd order in snacks and pizza and it was a little bit like summer camp. It was a lot of fun. So that was one fear I had that I just dealt with. It also it manifests itself in a very funny way. So, which was head on. and that's that as we're picking the jury, one of the potential jurors, you know, is brought in by the judge after someone's excused. Then the judge seats him and says, oh, you've heard everything so far. Do you have anything you want to disclose? And he says, yeah, I just think this case is all about money. And I don't like that there's this team of five lawyers against this one lawyer. And, you know, I come into this thinking they're just all about money and that's all they care about. And they have this big team and I don't like it. And the judge is asking questions and like he barely is surviving what should be a clear cause challenge. So then I get up. And so I was afraid of this. And part of it, I said, look, here, this is how we're going to do it. When I do jury selection, it'll be myself and Kim sitting at trial table. Kim and me, I don't know the proper English for that, but doesn't matter. And then when John, when you do opening, I will sit in the gallery and it will be you and Kim. Like, I don't want it to look huge. And that right away was blown, right? Right in jury selection. Yeah. Someone's calling out my worst fear. And I always realize that when someone calls it out, that's good. There's a reason I'm afraid of it, and let's hit it head on. So I get up in jury selection and so let's talk about that more. Can you tell me more about it? And it's like, yeah, it's like that, you know, in the Bible, that story. I'm like, David and Goliath? He said, yeah. And that makes me Goliath. Wow. I don't know what to do about that, because I've worked so hard to help the Shanks by bringing in a team. And if in that some way that's going to backfire now, that it's going to hurt them, then well. And so it's funny at this point, I'm having a conversation that I want to have with this person, and he's alienating the rest of the jury. And the judge is coming in and trying to save our team, it seems like, saying, now you realize, Mr. Potential Juror, that means that they're dividing their fee up five ways, which I thought was funny. And so we talked to him, and I kind of get that out there, and it's so extreme that, again, I believe it turns off a lot of the other jurors, and finally get him stricken for cause when he just pushes it super far. Or is he stricken for cause, or do I use a peremptory? I think maybe he's ultimately stricken for cause, but whatever it is, it's just an example of facing my fears and actually turning those into strengths. So what was really cool about this was I'm afraid of it, and I realize it's, I don't know, we'd say the elephant in the room, but it's there, right? People see it. And, you know, I can say things like I mentioned in closing just very quickly. And, you know, the other lawyer comes from a 14 lawyer law firm. But I don't want to spend too much time attacking him. So I feel like I've got to deal with this. And it comes to me because the defense lawyer also, in addition to this whole thing about the veteran driving blind, a lot of his arguments, and we address them, I address them in closing, and it doesn't matter. He comes in and does exactly what I say he's going to do. And that's that, well, they brought in an expert from Malibu, California. What was wrong with the prosthetic expert right here in Ohio? And they brought in this crash reconstructionist from Philadelphia. What's wrong with ours here? There was another crash reconstructionist on this case before, and all these lawyers, one of them from Portland, Oregon. So he does this thing. He can't help himself. I guess that's worked for him in other cases. And so in the second close, if there's something that's a little bit bothering me in the back of my mind, I just want to come out with it. I say, let me just be frank with you. You know, there were lawyers on this case before I came in, and I hate saying bad things about other law firms, but they just didn't do a very good job. And the reconstructionist they had was not as good as the reconstructionist you saw here. And their prosthetic expert, you know, you heard them making a big deal about disqualifying experts. Well, he's a good prosthetist. He can, you know, for legs. But Michael Shank needed a prosthetic. You saw he needs it for his arm and his leg. And the person we brought in has done more arms than anyone in this country. And so I felt like we built a team for the Shanks of some great lawyers, the best. I want the best for them. We brought in the best experts for them. They deserve that. And you deserve that. You deserve to hear from the best experts. We're asking you for a lot of money. And you deserve to hear from the best. They deserve the best. My paralegal, Kim, you know, they're saying all the people, we didn't get to introduce her. You know, there's John Bond with my office. I think he's an up-and-coming, amazing lawyer. You heard his opening? That was the first opening statement he's ever given. This is first trial. John, great job. I am proud of you. Kim, I think she's the best paralegal in the country. The experts we brought, the best. You deserve nothing less. So I just threw it all out there to really explain, in case in the back of their mind they were wondering, why didn't we hear from all these people? What's up with this big team? And just tied it together that we want the best for these people. And again, they presented amazingly well, which is probably worth talking about as well.
Tell me about that.
Yeah. So the my client really didn't need prepping on this because he met what was just, I know, the right ingredients for a big verdict on damages. And that was, Michael, can you tell the members of the jury those things that you can't do any longer? Nothing? Wow. What do you mean nothing? I couldn't do everything I could do before. You know, when you have an injury like this that's so apparent, half his body's gone, everyone's rooting for this guy. You know, at every closing, I want to be able to say at some point that my client has done everything he can. His family has done everything they can to help themselves. They can do nothing more. The next chapter in their book is going to be up to you. And so, like, what do you mean? I mean, you were a welder. You're a journeyman welder. You can still weld? He said, yeah, I can weld. They won't let me up on, like, 50-foot scaffold, so I can't do my job anymore, but I can weld. Well, you know, around the house. Oh, no, I do the laundry. I said, I just don't. You told me this before. We've talked about it, and I don't understand it. I brought a shirt. I brought a clean shirt from my laundry. will you show us? I brought a table. How do you fold a shirt? And he, you know, it takes him a little longer. He said he likes playing catch with his kids, two boys. Catch. I brought a ball. I had like a wiffle ball, and I asked him to bring his glove. How do you play catch? We play catch. I throw it to him. He catches it. He puts the mitt down, takes the ball out, throws it with his other hand, you know, goes through all of it. And okay, he does what has to be done. What I didn't do was have him go through a whole day in the life with every tiny thing. We gave like three examples. Jurors saw that he will persevere and do whatever he needs to do. And that was enough. They know that he doesn't have an arm and a leg. They can see it. And then his wife gets on the stand. Actually, we put the wife on first. She's a fourth grade teacher that left the classroom to be a social worker in the school because she thought she could help more kids that way. Just the nicest human being you could want to meet. And so here's this just wonderful family who is getting by the best they can. When I got to closing and went through the damages, I was going through the economics. And again, this was just a spur of the moment decision. I said, well, and we have on there 1.3 million, a little under 1.3 million for household services, the things around the house, you know, to mow the lawn and all that. You heard Mike mows the lawn. He bought a riding mower. He does weed whacking with a special attachment on his prosthetic arm. You know, is he entitled to that? We understand if you want to give it to him because he'd have the right to outsource it. But I'm going to ask you not to give it to him because we know he's not going to use the money to hire someone else. He's going to do it himself no matter how much money you give him. That's just Michael Shank. So that's another one of those matters of credibility. And also not thinking that it's like the zero-sum game that like I just gave up $1.3 million. Giving up that $1.3 million might have taken a $50 million verdict and taken it to $82 million.
Yeah, so that's a really hard thing. Like, again, it's that trust in yourself, trust in the jury. But it's that, again, goes to your credibility. Now, I see different approaches, and I've actually got to the point I'm a lot less dogmatic. I know what I have to do for me and who I am, but I see people that, you know, get good verdicts by being kind of mean to people and, you know, just trying to strike fear and anger. And I know that's not you. Your compassion is just part of who you are as a human being. How does that play into how you treat adverse witnesses when you're cross-examining them?
Yeah, thank you. I think there are many ways that we can win if you define win as a verdict in your favor. And a verdict in your favor, it is important, right? It's binary, and we want our, when truth's on our side. If it's not, we have the choice as plaintiffs, if we're doing plaintiff civil work, to not take the case. We think truth is on our side, then yeah, I want the verdict in my favor. I've often thought, because there are lawyers who take a less compassionate approach, and I guess I'm critical of that, but I've learned not to judge it. They need to do what they need to do. I'm glad that coming from a place of compassion has worked so well for me. It would be a dilemma to me, a huge moral dilemma, if treating people poorly in the courtroom would actually result in a better or bigger verdict. Fortunately for me, I can be fierce and compassionate. I can bring the compassion to the courtroom and really find a place to bring that. So a couple examples from this trial, and, you know, something that I guess now I've done two trials in a row, really thought of it that way, but it really comes from a place of wanting to reduce suffering for everybody involved, and that includes the wrongdoer. So the truck driver, many times, I mean, in the cases I have, they're always death cases or something like this, like an amputation or quadriplegia. And so the truck driver is human and almost always feels bad, right? Comes in the courtroom just feeling horrible that this happened, whether or not they think they're at fault. And so I talked to the Shanks ahead of time and looked over as part of my closing at the truck driver. And this only is good if it's really, really sincere. It can't be a performance. And said, Mr. Gerner, I want you to know that Michael and Brittany Shank have asked me to tell you, they know you didn't do this on purpose. And whatever our disagreements here in court, you know, we think you were negligent and should have looked better, but we know this was not on purpose. They forgive you for, I can't remember if I said forgive you, but just said that they acknowledge, they know this wasn't on purpose, and really hope that when this trial's over, that everyone moves on. This isn't something that you hold on to. So that's one part of it. That doesn't cost me anything. It could, again, if someone just hears me say this on this podcast and repeats it because, oh, that's what Michael Leeserman did. Don't do it because of that.
Or if it wasn't real and the energy came off that it was like a trick.
Yeah. And this was not a trick. I meant it. So that was one way that it played. And another way that it played was there was a police officer who was very against us. And I think he was upset that the alcohol was left out. And actually at one point he said he wanted to testify to a video. He saw a DOT camera that showed our client clearly way over the line and driving erratically. And we heard about that last minute after the judge struck the alcohol. And he came up with this, and no one else had seen this video, and the crash reconstructionist hadn't seen it. And we moved to strike it, and the judge said, yeah, you can't, it didn't exist anymore. There was supposedly a video he looked at. And so the judge said he couldn't testify to that. So he took the stand and he was visibly angry. They called him in their case in chief. He was on the stand for like 10, 15 minutes and was just visibly angry. And so how do I meet that officer? I first of all, try to understand where he's coming from. He's devoted his life to fighting alcohol and drugs that victimize people. And so I get where he's coming from. He's seen the other end of this, maybe a drunk driver killing people. So, okay, I understand that. We're not going to talk about it in this trial, but I can have compassion for this person. And the defense puts him on the stand and he says, I come over and I see the motorcyclist and he has shallow breathing. And I do first aid, you know, until the first responders come, the EMTs. And you know, reduce the blood flow, whatever he talks about that he helps Michael Schenck. And so I get up and the first thing I say is, and I've met with him like the week before when he was talking about this video, which by the way, we found out afterwards, there was no DOT camera at the site during this year. So there was no video. I'm glad the judge left that out. But in the moment, I can't bring the baggage of those things that are not in front of the jury to the jury. So what I have in front of me is an officer who just said he came to the scene because he was right across the street. So he was there like within a minute, 30 seconds. And I just said, Sergeant, I want to start with, on behalf of Michael and Brittany, thanking you for saving his life, for being there to render aid. Who knows if he would have made it, but for what you did. And I know you might say you're just doing your job, that you don't need a thanks, but I want to thank you. Thank you for what you do and for your first response there. And that really shook him, right? Because I meant it. Like, he was waiting for combat. And then the other fun thing is, so this imaginary line and where exactly the collision occurs, we spent a lot of time debating sequencing, and I made some last minute decisions. We didn't know Tuesday night what we're doing Wednesday morning. And I wasn't sure if I was going to call the crash reconstructionist because I was able to, we took his video deposition the day before trial because he was out of town. And so the other side wanted to notice it, but I noticed it. So I would call him in our case so I could ask questions first. And got some good stuff from him. Let me show you what the truck driver testified to. You've never seen the deposition. He said this and this, and he went through and didn't even know what he hit. Did you know that? Oh, I didn't know that. And that would be a reasonably careful truck driver would see what was in front of him to be seen, wouldn't he? Yeah. And so here, this truck driver was not driving reasonably carefully from what we just saw, and I played him the clips. That's right. So I got good stuff from him on that. And then the defense came in and, of course, said, you did a reconstruction. He was in the wrong place. Yeah. And, you know, the truck driver never left his lane. That's correct. So I'm afraid of that. I don't like that. But I decide I'm going to put him on first in our case in chief. And this is on Thursday. The trial starts on Tuesday and gets to the jury Friday night. So Thursday morning, I start out with the reconstructionist. Then I put on our crash reconstructionist, and he gets up. It's amazing. Has, I always have these Matchbox or Hot Wheel cars, like on a 1/64 scale aerial on the table. And so he's able to really, in front of the jury, just get down from the stand and talk about how this happened. And the marks, when I asked the police reconstructionist, there's all these marks that are on the roadway. And what about this one here? Is that a mark? Is this the point of impact? Because we think it is. Well, I'd say area of impact. I don't know. I didn't count that mark. Was that a scrape mark? Yeah, I didn't count that scrape mark because I wasn't sure. Maybe it was there before. I didn't count that as the first point of impact. I just did this whole area of impact. Okay, thank you, Sergeant. Then our crash reconstructionist gets up and says, this scrape here, this was part of the impact. And you'll see it's like 6 inches to the left of where the fluids are. And if we take that into account, it moves everything over 6 inches. And that clearly puts the motorcycle not just like on the imaginary line or over it where they put it, but it clearly puts him where he's supposed to be outside of the lane of travel. And then in their case in chief, they put on the sergeant, the one who seemed to have it in for us. And I said, thank you for saving his life. And I said, I just really have one question for you. I pulled up the image of the roadway marks on the crash scene. They had orange spray paint around it. And I said, now you were on the scene. Did you spray the orange paint? Was me or the other officer? Okay, but this mark up front here, this scrape mark, are we sure that was part of the crash or could it have been there before? And I don't know if he thought I was trying to, if he was trying to hurt me by thinking I wanted him to say it wasn't part of the crash, but he said, no, that was a fresh scrape mark. That's why we spray painted it. That was definitely part of this crash. Thank you. Thank you, Sergeant. And then so after like three questions, released him from the stand. And what was really cool about this is, you know, trial is real time. Trial for the jurors is happening in front of them. It's not looking back at time in time what happened. I mean, it is in a way, but it's actually the excitement of what's happening. So in closing, I addressed liability usually very little. I think out of an hour, 15-minute closing, it was maybe 10 minutes of liability. And it allowed me to say, first of all, you don't drive through the intersection essentially blind. You've got to see what's there to be seen. That's the whole case. And for those who care about where this occurred, what side of the imaginary line, we cracked it. We cracked it together, right? You heard Sergeant Cook say you didn't know if that mark was from it. And then you saw the Sean Harrington, the reconstructionist, show you exactly why it makes a difference. And then the sergeant came in and we cracked it together. He told you it was from this crash and that puts it over outside of the lane of travel. We figured it out together. And that was true. It was exciting. It was nice to, I wonder how many jurors knew that. I think most of them did, but some of them might not have known that. And others might not have really thought about it in that way as like, wow, we cracked it together. And the we is so important there. So that was another really fun part of this trial.
Now, I heard you talked about David and Goliath earlier. I heard you may have used some other biblical references.
Yeah. So this is very interesting for me. And so, again, this has to come from an authentic place. I'm a Jubu, right? I'm Jewish. I'm a practicing Zen Buddhist. And I went to Catholic school for 4 years growing up. I love studying religion. I'm fascinated by religion. And I actually believe that all religions at some mystical point have overlap. But I won't sidetrack into that. I didn't talk to the jury about that. But what I did was try to find a place in me that I can talk about the Bible. And I know that on any given jury, this was an 8-person jury, that there could be one or two or more people who that matters to them more than anything else in the trial. Something in the Bible? Okay, I don't care what else is there. I don't care about human law. I care about natural law. I don't know if they put it that way, but they want some reference to the Bible. So, you know, there's a few things I try to be ready. I think every trial lawyer thought about putting a webinar together on this for a decade now. And one of these days, maybe I will. Maybe you and I will. It'd be fun.
Yeah, it would be.
Corinthians 6:1-8 is something that every trial lawyer should know. And I did have a chance to quote that when someone was talking about, well, should we be in court? Are you talking about Corinthians 6:1-8? It does talk about not going to court, but that's really just against other people in your congregation, not someone in a situation like this. And that's pretty clearly the interpretation of that, but it was nice to be able to talk about that. And then what this case lent itself to were two metaphors. The one, I didn't know if I was going to use it because it seemed so corny, but I couldn't help myself. I was like, in closing, what do we say when something is as valuable as you can imagine? Like we say, and I'm sorry, I don't mean to belittle, but this is the saying, where does it come from? It costs an arm and a leg. Like, because we can't imagine something more valuable. Then I also, in closing, I've been talking about the civil system. And so I like to talk about, let's talk about what do we do? What if we didn't have a jury trial? Would we have, well, you know, some people might say in the Bible, it says an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. Would we just have retribution? Actually, that quote is only half the quote. Do you know the whole quote is an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, a hand for a hand, and a foot for a foot. Wow. We're not asking for Mr. Gerner's hand or foot. And as a matter of fact, if you really, and I don't mean to just be quoting the Bible here. I know for some people that's very important, for some people not as important. But I think what we can say is that in our Judeo-Christian ethic, like these are stories and it's a reference point just in general for society. So I said it that way so that people who were maybe atheist or agnostic or, you know, that it didn't seem like I wasn't just using it just to quote the Bible. So, but what do we do? And that's really that wouldn't be appropriate here, because if you read it, that's for when something's done intentionally. And that might've been the point where I looked at him and said, we know you didn't do this intentionally. But when you look at the Bible, and if someone does something negligently, and it actually talks about an axe head coming off an axe, so, you know, negligence and hitting someone in the head and killing them, what we do then is you send someone to the city of refuge, you exile them from the community. And, you know, that wasn't a day and age where that made sense and that was a real punishment. What's evolved through our Judeo-Christian ethic is you sitting here today on a jury. This is an extension of that, of what's talked about in the Bible. And so that's what you're here to do. So there was that way in which I could use the Bible and this greater sense of what the law is. And the last one I'll mention, and I've got to give credit here to AI. John Bond gave it to me, but it was through AI, and then I refined it through AI because I was looking for a metaphor of what was the defense doing by talking about these people from Santa Monica, California, and throwing all this dirt, right? And the best metaphor we had is it's like Samson. It's like Samson in the temple, and AI came up with this. It's beautiful. It's like Samson in the temple who would, when trapped, push the temple pillars and bring the whole temple down, killing everyone, including himself, rather than deal with the truth of the situation. And here, the lawyer on the other side is willing to jeopardize our whole system. You know, you've seen the arguments of, well, they're from out of town, and we'd throw away our whole system and its credibility to try to win this case. And again, I don't need to say it. They've seen that that's not me. I'm willing to strike a juror, even if it's harmful to my chances of winning the case. So yeah, those were some of the ways. It was more Bible quotes than and Bible stories than I had used before. I definitely use them in a way that I believe in and that I thought was credible. And I'm sure that didn't hurt us either.
Absolutely. I could talk to you about this case all day, and I plan on next time we get together, which hopefully is in a couple weeks in Santa Fe. So I just want to ask you about one more thing and then we'll wrap it up. How much money did you ask for? But more importantly, how did you come up with what the right amount of money was to ask for?
Yeah. Great question. I asked for $91 million. Returned a verdict, $82 million. I still like, for me personally, in jury selection, saying at the end, I'm going to ask for huge, and actually in this case, I said a huge, huge amount of money. And I didn't ask for it in opening. I didn't reference a number. I did in closing. That's my style. I know a lot of great lawyers, maybe you do it this way, Michael, that ask for a number in opening. I don't think there's a right or wrong way to do it. I just prefer doing it that way. What I did not do are all those things in that horrible Texas Supreme Court case.
Chauhan, Gregory versus Chauhan. Fighter planes and works of art.
That used to be a regular part of my closing, the fighter planes, the cost of the Picasso or the Van Gogh. And what I realized is, I don't need that. I don't need that for a big verdict. So I didn't mention any of those things. Because my wife Rena's tired of dealing with those on the remitter motions. She's the only spouse who's probably like, when I tell her there's a big verdict, she's like, why can't you get a settlement? Now I've got to write all these remitter responses. But fortunately, the case has been settled to the satisfaction of all parties. But in any event, so many times, in Ohio, I'm allowed to do a per annum. I kind of like that. Talked about, you know, is it $1 million to $2 million per year? I find the jury just ignores that, and they give what they think is right, although it gives them some basis. I did talk about two other things I think would be helpful. One thing that didn't work, and I saw someone else do this, and it's a little too cutesy, I won't do it again, but was when you're coming up with a number, and I had a range, and I said, how about 913? That's 913. Was it 913? Whatever the date was, it was the date of this crash, and it was also Brittany Shank's birthday. And so I said, give her, you know, instead of her birthday being just the tragedy of the crash, give her something to remember on that, like give that date a positive spin. And so I just thought it was something people could latch on to. I'm glad they didn't, because I don't know how that would work in appeal. Like, that wasn't a rational basis. So I did some of that. And the other thing that I think is important was I talked about how this is a huge number, you know, per annum, I guess would be an answer, direct answer to your question. But the other thing is dealing with all the obstacles that may exist for the juror to give that kind of number. And I did say something like, you know, we're here in Steubenville, Ohio, and someone might say, $91 million? Do you know you're in Steubenville, Ohio? We're not in New York City. And I would say, well, you know, if there's that kind of verdict in New York City, why wouldn't someone here in Steubenville be entitled the same amount of money? Don't people value the freedom to do what they want when they want here just as much as New York City? Some people might say they value it more here. I don't know. I wouldn't go that far, but it's certainly at least as much. And I believe that by the end, this jury was happy to say, this is one of our own. And someone in Steubenville, Ohio, in Jefferson County, Ohio, can receive an $82 million verdict when they're worthy and good people. Absolutely. And I think I had a great enough connection with those jurors that if any of them, heaven forbid, have some kind of a catastrophe with a truck, I think they'd probably look to us. I feel like we're really bonded.
Well, thank you so much, Michael.
I really appreciate the chance to be on your program. Like you said, I could talk with you all day, but we have to give the listeners a finite time on the podcast. Thank you for putting on Trial Lawyer Nation. You reach so many people and really help lawyers learn techniques, learn skills. And that's a way that we can really affect lots more people than either you or I can do individually. So thanks for putting on this podcast.
Well, thank you for coming on and sharing how you did it. And hopefully that leads some of our listeners and me to get better results. So thank you all. Thank you, Michael. Thank everyone for listening. And tune in next time on Trial Lawyer Nation.
Thank you for joining us on Trial Lawyer Nation. I hope you enjoyed our show. If you'd like to receive updates, insider information, and more from Trial Lawyer Nation, sign up for our mailing list at triallawyernation.com. You can also visit our episodes page on the website for show notes and direct links to any resources in this or any past episode. To help more attorneys find our podcast, please like, share, and subscribe to our podcast on any of our social media outlets. If you'd like access to exclusive plaintiff lawyer only content and live monthly discussions with me, send a request to join the Trial Lawyer Nation Insider Circle Facebook group. Thanks again for tuning in. I look forward to having you with us next time on Trial Lawyer Nation.
Each year, the law firm of Cowan Rodriguez Peacock pays millions of dollars in co-counsel fees to attorneys nationwide on trucking and commercial vehicle cases. If you have an injury case involving death or catastrophic injuries and would like to partner with our firm, please contact us by calling 210-941-1301 to discuss the case in detail and see where we can add value in a partnership. This podcast has been hosted by Michael Cowan and is not intended to, nor does it create, the attorney-client privilege between our host, guest, and any listener for any reason. Content from the podcast is not to be interpreted as legal advice. All thoughts and opinions expressed herein are only those from which they came.